You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Think I'll go out to Alberta. Weather's good there in the fall. I got some friends that I could go to work in for.
Still, well, I know it's probably, I don't know, I probably should have played Bruce Coburn. Hey, was that what I should have done, Andy?
That would have been cliche, I think, Drew.
But there's some interesting stories in this book that have to do with Neil Young, that have to do with Ian and Sylvia Tyson, and this great country of ours, Canada. Mr. Bernie Finkelstein, he is basically, for all intents and purposes, a Canadian recording industry legend, and he is the author of True North, A Life in the Music Business. Story after story after story. I thought David Maynes had too many stories. This guy, oh my goodness. Fantastic stuff. Mr. Bernie Finkelstein. Bernie, how you doing, man?
Hey, just fine, thank you. How about yourself?
Fantastic. Can you lay out, first of all, right off the top, that story where you go down to New York, I think you were 19 years old, and you're ready to kind of do some business down there, and you're at the Cafe Ogogo in Greenwich Village, and you, who are you pitching?
Yeah, this is 1965, so it was a long, long time ago. I have a band called The Poppers, who go on to become, you know, fairly successful. Not quite over the top. One of the members later starts Lighthouse, who people will be more familiar with. Anyway, it's 1965. Just got a record contract with MGM Records, one of the big companies during that period. And I'm down at the Cafe Ogogo trying to arrange a showcase of sorts for the Poppers to come and play in New York. The Cafe Ogogo is the biggest and best club in Greenwich Village. It's where everybody plays and an important place. And I've got this meeting with the owner. And I sit down with him. It's in the afternoon. And he looks up at me and says, okay, I'll book your band. I've got a great idea. You guys are from Toronto. I've got Ian and Sylvia coming in. They're going to fill the place. I'll give you that show. And, you know, I think about it very quickly, and I'm a big fan of Ian and Sylvia's. Big, big, big fan. And I know how well they're doing, and Four Strong Winds is a huge hit around that time. But I also know it's not the right pairing for the Poppers. The Poppers are a psychedelic rock band. And anyway, to make a long story short, I kind of, you know, take a deep breath and I say, Howard, that's the name of the guy that owned the club. I said, Howard, terrific idea, but is there something else we could do? And I look kind of down at his date book, which had these big squares the way people have monthly calendars. Only his was quite large because he's got all his options in there. And I see the Jefferson Airplane. Now, this is before flower power has bloomed. It's before Jefferson Airplane had White Rabbit as a number one record. It's several months before that. But I'd heard a lot about the Jefferson Airplane via that kind of a grapevine that ran between Yorkville and Haight-Ashbury and Greenwich Village and other places like that. And I say, listen, Howard, what about the Jefferson Airplane? Their first time in New York, love to get that show. Howard gives us the show, and the Poppers become an instant sensation because it's the hottest ticket in New York. So much happens because of that.
Yeah.
I get to meet and become partners with Bob Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, because of that gig. And it's well outlined in the book, but that's basically the Ian and Sylvia story.
And who showed up with two joints in her hand at your door?
Yeah, that's right. It was a four-day show in New York. And after the opening night, which had been just sensational, I get a knock on my hotel room door, staying at the Gorham Hotel, and it's Linda Eastman. And for those that don't remember Linda Eastman, they're going to remember Linda McCartney. Several years later, she marries Paul McCartney. She knocks on the door. She has a couple of joints in her hand. She's a professional, or she's trying to be a professional photographer. I'm not sure if that's all she did at the time. And she says, Bernie, I'm Linda Eastman. Can I come in and talk to you about the Poppers? I'm in love with what they did last night, and I'd love to shoot them. So she comes in, and we light up a joint, it was just the next day, or maybe it was on the fourth day of the gig. We go to Central Park, and she shoots shots of the Poppers.
Unbelievable. Seriously, I feel like sitting at your feet like my grandfather. I'm not saying you're old. I'm just saying the stories, you know, the stories. Unbelievable. Okay, let's change gears, Bernie. First of all, what do you think about the Jays this year?
Yeah. In the off season, the Jays should have spent some more money. That's what I think. I mean, I like the team. I think they're really, really entertaining. I see Jose really coming on strong right now, and I'm sure he's going to be for the rest of the year. But they're missing a big bat, and they're really missing another pitcher in terms of really being a lock to get in the after season. And I think the Jays should have spent some more money. I'm not saying they should have got Prince Fielder. Maybe that was too expensive, but there was other choices. I'm not saying they should have necessarily gotten Yu Darvish, but they could have got Gio Gonzalez. And, you know, Toronto's a major market, and sometimes I think the owners treat it like it's a secondary market. With all that being said, getting away from the business, entertaining team, love the youth. They're gonna give the front runners a lot of fits.
Baltimore.
All the way to the end, I think.
Listen, that was the most concise. Where's TSN? We need a Gino or something. We'll call up. I don't understand what it is with Jewish guys in baseball, like Sandy Brokaw, whose father started William Morris, right?
Yeah.
Huge Dodgers junkie and just all over. Larry King. Every time I talk to Larry King, it's, 90% of the conversation he wants to talk about baseball. What is it with you guys?
But you know what I think that was? I mean, I missed just a small part of what you said. I noticed that you said the Dodgers, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it has anything to do with being Jewish. But, you know, when I grew up, my father was a huge Brooklyn Dodgers fan as well in the 50s. And I think it's because the Brooklyn team was in New York, but unlike the Yankees, I think Brooklyn was pretty Jewish in those days.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know for sure. I've never done a sociological study, and I guess that may be part of it. I don't really know, though. I think, I don't know.
Yeah, no, okay. Well, just leave it with I don't know. Okay, Toronto, Trenton, England, Germany for 6 months, a short time in Shiloh, moved around because your father was in the military, right?
Yeah, he was in the Royal Canadian Air Force. He was a career Air Force warrant officer. And I was like an Army brat with wings, really, an Air Force brat, and we lived all over the place.
Well, being in the Royal Canadian Air Force, did he hang out with Roger Abbott very much at all?
Yeah. Well, I think I said Air Force.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
I think it was me that ended up in the Air Force.
Yeah, that's right.
An unpaid member of the Air Force.
Oh, man.
Did
you ever end up finding your father's military records?
You know, I never did. Now, that's partly my problem, probably. When I face up against bureaucracy of any kind, I don't know that I tend to wilt, but I tend to try to figure out how to get around it.
Yeah.
And I wanted my father's military records mostly so I could date where I was when certain things happened, because we moved so many times. I went to about 13 schools.
Wow.
Before I finally quit in grade 10. But
you quit in grade 10 too?
I found another way to do it, but I kept on running into, some resistance, call this person, call that person, then you get left on hold by the Department of Military Affairs or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I never did, no. I guess if I would just get somebody else to do it for me, they probably would have. But.
So both mom and dad have passed.
Yeah.
Who had the greater influence on you?
Well, I think probably my mother. That's a good question. My father died when I was quite young. My father died in 1971. So, I was only 25 or something like that, and 26. And I didn't really get to know my father all that well as an adult. I mean, he was an adult, but I wasn't yet. And so, you know, I mean, I love them both very, very much.
Okay, so you're laying in bed when you're in England. You're listening to Radio Luxembourg.
Yep.
Would your parents ever get angry at you for listening to that man who shook his pelvis so much?
You know what? They were the ones that gave me an Elvis Presley record. They actually went out and bought me my first record player when we lived in England. We were stationed there for 3 years in a place called, just outside of Nottingham, in a base called Langar. And they bought me a record player, and they bought me three records, and one of the records was Elvis Presley, Hound Dog. So, no, I don't think so. I think they were a bit alarmed at my... non-stop playing of music over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, I had the, you know.
But I don't think so. No, I think they thought it was pretty healthy, you know.
You and I have a couple things in common. One, I bolted out of school after I finished grade 9. Somewhere in grade 10 I finished. And then the other thing is just voraciously playing music, which was not a good thing in my case. And my co-host here, Andy, he and I grew up together. Andy, you know, I'd be downstairs with that stereo, and I'd have Kiss.
Kiss Destroyer.
I'd have Kiss Destroyer.
Meatloaf.
Just our Meatloaf cranking. And Bernie, you don't know this, but this was in the base. I grew up in a funeral home.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so not cool when the middle of a funeral is going on and Kiss Destroyer is playing, you know? Not cool.
Yeah, no kidding, man. That's amazing that you grew up in a funeral home, though. That's wonderful.
I remember when I asked you if you'd come on the show and talk about your book, and you're like, well, you know, I don't have a lot of God stuff to talk about, man. But listen, with a name like Bernie Finkelstein, you've had some God stuff.
Well, you know, I grew up Jewish, and still I am Jewish and proud to be Jewish. I'm not even close to Orthodox. I'm not even Reform, really. I'll always be Jewish, and I had a bar mitzvah, and I grew up. My mom and dad, even though my dad was in the Air Force, you know, they kept a pretty Jewish home and kept the holidays, and I have some strong knowledge about the religion.
But here's the thing: I know that there's a generation of guys out there who, and maybe it's how they're wired, maybe it's the generation, I don't know what it is, but like for example, Moses Neimer. I've asked Moses to come on and talk about through his people. And, I've been told he doesn't want to talk about what he believes. He's happy to come on and talk about what senior citizens believe, what the Zoomer crowd believes, but he doesn't want to talk about his beliefs. Can you relate to that?
I couldn't presume what Moses is, what's behind that.
But have you and Moses, because you and he are buddies, have you talked about God?
No, we've never really engaged in that kind of conversation whatsoever.
Yeah.
I can understand people's reluctance to perhaps do that. It's not so much that I'm reluctant. I'm not reluctant at all. I don't think I have very much to add to the conversation.
Right. Yeah, that's what you said.
Is more to the point because, you know, I don't really practice. I mean, I have a great respect. I mean, religion is... and I think when you talk about religion, I mean, I suppose you got to embrace all kinds of things, spirituality as well.
Right.
I have a great, healthy respect for all of that, I've tried to understand what a lot of the world's religions are about, but I've never really been tempted to go any further than saying I'm Jewish,
right,
even though I don't particularly spend a lot of time in synagogue.
Right, but I'm thinking about the scene you grew up in, right? The Haight-Ashbury stuff, the Yorkville stuff, the Greenwich stuff, the drugs, man, the artists, you know, the creative minds, the philosophical conversations. I just think I would have just been loved to have been a fly in the wall just to hear you guys hash through. You like that?
Nice segue.
Yeah, hash through. All these big life questions, and
they've always been part of the conversation, and I would say that I've had those kinds of conversations all my life with people.
Yeah.
Not necessarily on a daily basis. I used to talk to Bruce a lot about these things.
Well, that's where I was going next. I mean, you can't hang around Bruce Coburn without getting a little bit of spiritual stuff on your sleeve.
Well, it's not that he, you know, walks around talking about it all the time, but every once in a while I get curious about things and I'll ask him and we'll engage in conversations and, you know, he's a pretty interesting and an enlightened person, in my opinion,
yeah,
about these things.
You know, at the risk of bringing up Larry King twice in a conversation with you, I asked Larry about his beliefs, and he's an agnostic. You know, here's the interesting thing. Grew up Jewish. He's an agnostic. He's married to a Mormon. He said to me a couple times, I just can't make the leap. I just can't make – to have faith in something like – you know, he's good friends with Dr. Billy Graham. I can't make the leap.
Well, I can kind of relate to that. I'm not – I mean, I never say never. You know, I have to say the jury's out for me.
Yeah.
I'm not slamming my and this is not just a matter of convenience. I mean, it's obviously better to if there is a God, it's better to say you believe in him. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, of course, you know, if he can be fooled, he or she or whatever can be fooled so easily, then what's the point anyway?
Yeah.
But I keep the door open, and I have a great regard and I truly have great respect for those that do. And I've always loved Bruce's song, though, Justice, you know, what's been done in the name of Jesus, what's been done in the name of Moses, et cetera, what's been done in the name of Buddha. You know, just kind of, it's when people use these organized religions to enforce points on other people that I get concerned. Other than that, I mean, if it gives people comfort, I think it's a wonderful thing.
We are on the line with Bernie Finkelstein, and Bernie's got this killer book. By the way, the writing, the chapters, the pictures, this is a perfect book for someone with ADD. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
True North, A Life in the Music Business.
ADD, I don't know.
Forwarded by Murray McLaughlin. Take us back to this time. You ready? You and Dan Hill are sitting on the Concorde, rushing over to Europe, drinking champagne.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Crazy.
Well, Dan had that great hit of his. I think everybody knows this one, Sometimes When We Touch. It was the biggest single that I was ever involved in my career, period. And the record is sitting number one in North America, U.S. and Canada. And we get the opportunity to go and do Tops of the Pops, the great British TV show that is, you can only get on that show if your record's in the top 20. And it was the equivalent of the Dick Clark show, although even bigger in some respects because it was the only one in the UK that really counted. But the only trick was we were on tour with Art Garfunkel, and we had this little two-and-a-half-day window, and we get offered the opportunity to do the show, and the only way it could really be done was to take the Concorde over, take the Concorde back, and make it back to Cleveland in time to do a sound check and do the show in Cleveland with Art Garfunkel. And that Art Garfunkel tour was first tour Art Garfunkel had done since Simon and Garfunkel had broken up. Anyhow, long story short, they book us on the Concorde, and there we are. We're selling, you know, 35,000 records a day. We're on the Concorde, and they're serving caviar and champagne. And, you know, you get on the plane, and 3.5 hours later, you've arrived in London. And the next day, we do Tops of the Pops. The next morning, we go out to the airport. We get back on the Concorde. Now, I may get these times a little bit bizarrely out of, but here it is, certainly metaphorically correct, is we get on the airplane at 10 a.m. in the morning, and we arrive back at JFK in New York at 10:15 in the morning with the clocks changing and everything, transfer planes, go to Cleveland, arrive in Cleveland by 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Dan does the show that evening in Cleveland, no problem at all. And we just finished taping Tops of the Pops, and Dan's record goes top 10 in the UK, consequently,
Unbelievable. Now, I'm sitting here with a co-host, Andy Walton. I told you earlier, Andy and I grew up together. Andy's a music junkie as well. He's in a band. Chicks dig him.
At least one chick digs me.
That's
yeah.
why everybody gets into bands.
Yeah. Well, his wife digs him anyway. So here's the deal. Who's the loudest band in the world, Bernie?
Well, I used to think it was my band, the Kensington Market. That's what I used to think. So, but I don't know currently who's loud.
Andy, who would you say?
Well, I was thinking you were talking about Spinal Tap when I saw the I think that's the loudest band in England, though, but I think Motorhead would probably make the claim. But Kensington Market, that's an interesting story. I did have one question for you, though, Bernie. Just looking at the different artists that you represented, Bruce Cockburn and Murray McLaughlin and, of course, Kensington Market and even Rough Trade, some of these legends of the Canadian music business, what set some of these guys apart? Because there's probably a list of 10 times longer of bands that didn't make it. So was there something about these guys that said, you know, sets them apart?
Well, you know, I think it was because they were, I think a couple of things that I would say they're both equal in my mind, and that is they were great songwriters, first and foremost, and then also very unique and original. And, you know, I always look for that. And, you know, I can't say that I always got it right, but with the things that really worked for me, it always came down to that same thing, having great songs and being very original for the time they were in and the very, very important qualities as far as I'm concerned.
I read somewhere that you said, you know, a telltale sign of someone that I don't want to work with is when they say something like, I'll do anything to get into the music business or to be big or whatever.
Well, that's right. That usually, now to be more specific, what I was really trying to say was, although the idea of them doing anything promotionally would also concern me to some degree, but what I was really trying to get at in that was that the idea that they're willing to tailor their music to be successful is a sure sign that I don't want to work with them, for sure.
Okay, so listen, we've got Bruce Cockburn here with One and Where the Lions Are, and of course that took Bruce into the U.S. market. Dan Hill, sometimes when we touch into the U.S. market, what happened with Murray McLaughlin?
Well, we struggled. I mean, now Murray did build up an audience in the U.S. on the folk club circuit and used to regularly play.
But he was way out ahead of that scene.
Yes, he was. He was doing what we now think of as Americana roots music, but it was well before that had taken hold as a genre. So songs like Farmer's Song, which were not really country, but were sort of country and weren't really folk, but were sort of folk. You know, that's the kind of thing he was doing. But we never could quite break a single in America. Now, you know, the thing to understand is, although I tell the story through those eyes, if you're talking to Murray, you know, it's not a big deal to him. I mean, Murray doesn't judge his career in terms of whether he had that hit in America. But for me, because I loved Murray's music so much, and because I knew that getting a hit in America meant so much in terms of like where your career could go and the new vistas and opportunities that opened up, it always just sort of disappointed me, mostly because I just thought Murray was so great and I wanted the world to hear him.
Yeah.
And the easiest way for the world to hear somebody is through America. That's still kind of true. I mean, who do Canadians talk about today? Well, they talk about Arcade Fire and Feist. Why? Because they had big hits in America.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Like Feist, I mean, she was the first woman to have that hit on an indie label. Isn't that incredible? Really? Really?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the reasons that inspired me to want to write a book is not because, you know, I mean, she's great, and I just heard a person on the radio one day say, well, that's the first Canadian female who ever had a hit, a number one record on an independent Canadian label. And I thought, holy mackerel, man, they just forgot about Sarah McLachlan, and that was only 5 years ago, never mind Patsy Gallant back, 35 years ago. But nonetheless, it's an important achievement, of course.
Yeah, but let's quote Margaret Atwood, right? What did she say? Canadians suffer from cultural amnesia?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure she's the one that said that. I attribute it to her. I don't know if that's, but it's a great quote, whatever it is that Canadians suffer from cultural amnesia. And the other thing, Drew, that I kind of bring into that equation is that a country that can't remember its past has no future. Mm. And I don't know who exactly said that, but I think that there's big truth in that. I don't think that that means people have to know exactly what I did, but I wanted to get the story of my times on paper so that, you know, I don't know, in 25 years from now, if there's still a library, somebody can go through one and find a dusty copy of that book, and they can go, oh, I see. This is a point of view of what happened here.
Buddy, if there's still libraries in 20 years, then Margaret Atwood will be very happy.
Yeah,
Rob
yeah,
Ford
and,
won't.
And Rob Ford will not have been elected for a fifth term, I guess.
Okay, so a couple of guys I've had on my show over the years, and they've both shared some interesting stories about, you know, back in the day. Skip Prokop, who I just spoke to this morning, actually, he wanted to say hello to you, and he said, like, you know, tell him to shoot me an email or something. Were you? By the way, did you go to that Leonard Cohen tribute thing?
No, I was out of town. You know, I'm not in Toronto as much anymore. I got a farm in an old farmhouse, really, on some acreage in Prince Edward County, a couple hours
east. Yeah, but hold on. So here's the thing. You didn't show up, but surprisingly, Leonard Cohen showed up. Like, he's a notorious no-show.
Well, you know, Leonard will go anywhere. I'm a lot harder to get to.
Boy, that would have been amazing. I mean, you know, the Glenn Gould Award, you know, Massey Hall. But anyway, Lighthouse did sort of a little after-party thing for them, and Paul Hoffert was there and the whole deal. But Skip, and then there's George Oliver, who's been on my show. Of course, remember him from the Mandela.
Yeah, the Mandela, really one of the seminal and great bands of that period in the 60s.
Yeah. So these guys would tell me about times where their bands would be playing, I think on Queen Street, maybe, I'm not quite sure where it was, but they downtown Toronto, and they'd be at different clubs just down the street from each other. And when the concerts...
That was in Yorkville.
Oh, sorry. It was in Yorkville, yeah. So when the concerts finished, their fans would go out on the streets and fight each other. They were just like crazy different scene.
I write about that. You know, we used to think of the, you know, I managed the Poppers. My old friend Randy Markowitz, Randy Dandy, actually. He managed the Rogues, who then became the Mandela. And there was like two camps in Yorkville for a short while. There was the Greasers, we used to call them. And they were the guys and the gals who loved Blue-Eyed Soul. So they loved the Mandela, John Lee and the Checkmates, Bobby Chris and the Imperials. And then there was the kind of hippies, you know, and they loved the Poppers and the Ugly Ducklings and Jack London and the Sparrow and the Minor Birds. And I sort of recount that tale just a wee bit and talk about the fact that at a certain point in Toronto, what happened is, I don't like to really use the word hippies, but the psychedelic music sort of won out. Not that Blue-Eyed Soul entirely disappeared, but it really became more of a rock and roll town.
Well, it's funny. Every time I run into George Oliver, we always recount our it was one of the first times I think we met. We were at the James Brown concert up at Casino Rama. And it was after that concert, I went up to James Brown's suite and had an interview with him. And it turned out to be the longest interview. It was a 30-minute. I mean, the guy runs out of interviews after 10 minutes, you know.
Well, he's the greatest. I mean, James Brown is what the godfather of soul, they say. And, George, you know, George Oliver's band Mandela, I used to go see them right around the corner on Avenue Road, just a block north of Yorkville, a club called the Devil's Den. And they were amazing. I mean, with Dominic Triano, and they made a couple of great singles, great records.
Yeah.
And you know, we all thought that they were. I mean, what used to happen is the fans might have gone out in the street and fought, but actually the bands would all go over to the Colonnade, which is just another block or two away. An all night restaurant was there, and we'd all sit around and chat together. You know. Just talking about Skip, by the way, it was Skip that gave me my opportunity to manage the Poppers and, in a way, got my career started, you know, sort of took me out of washing dishes at the club I was working in and that band was playing in. And you know, 45 years later, I woke up with a book out, Drew, and here I am.
Here you are. That's right. Bernie Finkelstein on the phone with us, just about ready to say goodbye to you here. First of all, very kind of you to say that about Skip, you know. Boy, he's done his hard yards, and but still, just a dynamic drummer, and
dynamic, and you know, listen, he went on with Lighthouse to have his fair share of success.
Yeah,
I ended up putting out Lighthouse's greatest hits actually towards the end of. I had it out for about 10 years, and we almost sold another gold record on it. It did so well.
Wow, amazing stuff, man! Story after story, this is great. Okay, listen. You've also said years of debauchery, Bernie, of debauchery.
I don't know if I'd say debauchery.
But hold on, you said you never got addicted to anything.
No, I never did. No, I definitely did a lot of drugs. A lot of them were soft drugs. I mean, you know, marijuana, acid, MDA. And I did graduate, if you want to call it graduate. I did do some hard drugs and stuff, but I never really, you know, I got smart. I actually left Toronto at the end of just late in 68, early 69, and went up north to Killaloo to escape that whole scene, actually. Hmm. And then I took about a year to think things through, and that's when I decided to start True North. And although I didn't entirely give up smoking grass, et cetera, I sort of got a handle on it. But it was dangerous in the 60s. I don't want to over-romanticize it, but
yeah.
The 60s, everybody was high in the 60s. You know, I guess not everybody, but everybody I knew was.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I was visiting with Diane Cannon last year. I was at her apartment in Hollywood, and we were chatting away, and she was explaining some of the goofy stuff. But in that exact same time period, crazy things that were just going on. And
well, the 60s was kind of an interesting time, and I know people are, you know, the younger generation's really sick, I think, of having it talked about so much. But on the other hand, they're really fascinated by it, and. Mm. You know, I don't think there's any question that, you know, history is going to prove it to be a pretty interesting time. I mean, musically, we can see the evidence of that.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, you are a fascinating and gracious man. You really are. You've been quite kind to me over the last number of years, of course, trying to book Bruce on our show, and very, very gentle with my insistence. So thank you, Bernie, so much.
Well, Drew, it's our pleasure, believe me, and it's my pleasure to be on your show. I'm thankful for the time.
Well, I look forward to meeting you one of these days face-to-face, and boy, it would have been fun. I'm looking at the cover of your book, and of course, I don't know if everybody comments on this, but, dude, the picture of you on the front of that book, there's somebody... who does that remind you of? I'm showing you Andy. Who does that remind you of?
Well, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Rob Reiner character, on Spinal Tap, to tell you the truth.
Just classic stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's just a killer shot of you. So anyway, listen, we'll move along. Bernie Finkelstein on the show, True North, A Life in the Music Business, is the book. Oh, seriously, a fantastic and a riveting read. So many stories in here. Bernie, thank you for what you've done for Canadian music, and thanks for joining us, man.
Well, Drew and Andy, thank you both very much. Appreciate it, and I'll speak to you soon, I hope.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Oh, boy, that was cool. That was fun for me.
And I just say that with all due respect, because I love that movie. It's one of my top three. So
you're a Spinal Tap junkie.
I know I am.
What is wrong with you?
It's just, it's imprinted on me. Where's that book? Let me see that
Something's
book.
Imprinted on you. You should probably read it.
True North. I'm going to.
Little Bruce Colburn. This is the song called Justice. This is the song that Bernie Finkelstein was talking about in our interview with him. If you missed any of today's show, including that interview with Bernie Finkelstein, you can go to our website by the end of the week. Friday, we'll have it posted for your listening pleasure. Steal it. Spread it around. Pass it around, man.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca. And in the name of peace,
everybody. It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.